Welcome to the University Library Colloquia series hosted by Libraries Computing and Technology. I'm Ruth Ann Jones, one of the organizers of the series. Our speaker today is Gary Sykes, a professor in the Departments of Educational Administration and Teacher Education in the College of Education here at Michigan State. Professor Sykes' research interests are currently focused on two important areas: teacher professionalism, teacher learning and professional development, and policies related to professional improvement, and school choice policies and their impact on educational systems. His most recent publications include studies in both areas. He's the co-editor of a new book, Teaching as the Learning Profession, and co-author of a new report, School Choice Policies in Michigan, The Rules Matter, both issued this year. Dr. Sykes has his undergraduate degree from Princeton University and a doctorate in education from Stanford University. He'll be speaking to us today on the future of education, school choice comes to Michigan. Please welcome Dr. Gary Sykes.
Would everybody be happier if we sort of rearranged these chairs in a circle so we could have a bit more collegial conversation given the size of the group? I would be more comfortable than standing in a podium giving a formal lecture, although I will make some introductory remarks, but this is the sort of thing that I suspect people will be interested in having some interaction. So maybe we could start off and just do that and have a little bit more informal session. The other thing I should probably say at the outset is it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. A lot of you probably thought that you'd like to maybe drop in, see if it was interesting, and maybe needed to leave in the middle. Don't feel embarrassed to do that. That's understood with this sort of thing. So come and go as you please. Is this better? Excellent. I'll talk for a while and then open things up for a discussion. But in the course of my talking, if you have a burning question that you want to ask, let's stop and smell the flowers as we go. Among the central questions under debate today and the ongoing argument the American people have always had with themselves about education, there are three that have achieved prominence. One is, how good or bad is education in America? You would think that with all of the data collected on America and its education system, we would have a fair degree of consensus on whether we're doing a good or a bad job, but it's actually the fact that fierce debates rage on whether the education system is healthy or not. It's often the case that those who want to reform it have a stake in portraying it as doing badly. But there has been revisionist commentary recently that says it's not doing anywhere near as badly as some of the critics have made it out to be. So one critical question is just how well or badly are we doing? The second question is, what sort of education do we want in this country? And I'll have more to say about that as we go. That's the oldest question of all that Americans have been deeply divided on since the founding of the Common School. And the third, which is really the focus of the talk today, is what role should government play in the provision of schooling? That's a relatively recent question added to the other two. It has been assumed for most of the 200 years of the American school system that it would be a government school system. That is receiving an interesting challenge today. Around this last question, the role of government, two broad responses are contending for prominence in the country today. one of these takes note of the great anomaly that the United States represents among nations in the world. Ours is virtually the only education system as radically decentralized as it is. That is to say, the norm around the world is ministerial systems of education in which a single central agency of government runs a national school system that provides a high degree of uniformity in the elements of the system, the training of teachers, the funding of schools, the curriculum, the testing system, and so on, for the entire nation. And most nations around the world simply assume that education is a national function and there should be a single national system of education. For interesting historical reasons, the United States is absolutely peculiar in its tradition of local control and the extraordinary diversity of education within a country as large and diverse as ours. Now, what that fact has meant for one brand of reformers is we have to introduce a lot more standardization into the system as a means of improving the quality of the system. And so one prominent response to the perceived difficulties of education is to call for a national curriculum, a national testing system, a more centralized, standards-driven system that would come to have powerful influence across all of the localities that make up the nation. And part of what fuels that particular line of development is just this comparison with other nations. In particular, some of the recent international comparisons of achievement that show the United States as being somewhat middling in achievement in areas such as mathematics and science lend credence to the view that we have to have much more strongly nationalized and centralized control of the system. Now, that control in the United States might be exercised from the federal level, except that education isn't a federal function. Constitutionally, it's a state function, and therefore, the drive to centralize education is playing out across the states. And so what we see is strong movements to exercise much greater accountability for K-12 education exercised by states. That's typically taking the form of having a test and attaching stakes to it. The stakes might be whether you graduate from high school, whether you progress from the fourth to the fifth grade, whether dollars are awarded to individual teachers or schools for producing well on the tests, or sanctions and penalties are exacted on schools that fail to measure up. But there's an entire centralized accountability press going on in many states around the country that essentially increases the influence of government over the education system. The version here in Michigan that we'd be familiar with would be the MEEP, and the influence of the MEEP on schools. But there's another response around this question about the role of government that's contending with the first one, and that is a response that seeks to shift from a system of government-run schools to a system of regulated competitive delivery in which government does not directly provide the service but instead establishes the conditions and the funds for alternative providers. This latter development is the subject of my talk today. Let me say that again because the idea may not be familiar to all of you. One thing that government can do is to directly provide a service. It can run the postal service. It can recruit and run the army. It can run a system of schools. But another thing that a government can do is not to directly provide the service through agencies of government, but rather simply create the circumstances under which any number of other providers might actually deliver services. And then what the government does is to simply establish the funding mechanisms and the regulations under which alternative providers provide the services. So, what's happened to healthcare in the United States in the last decade? Revolution. We have gone from essentially a government-run system of healthcare through large programs like Medicare and Medicaid to the rise of the HMO and increasingly a shift to government-regulated competitive delivery of services. And that is working a dynamic and dramatic revolution in the ways in which healthcare is provided in the United States. Why shouldn't we do that in education? Why should we believe any longer that government ought to run schools, as opposed to having the government set up the circumstances under which any number of other entities might be the ones running schools? What kinds of entities? Corporations, churches, teacher cooperatives, you name it. As long as somebody operates within a set of regulations that the government has established, why not diversify the providers of schooling? That's the idea. Now, this shift from a government system of schools to a regulated competitive delivery model joins two powerful but distinct ideas. One is the expansion of family choice of schools. That is to say, under the current and historical system of American schooling, Americans didn't have a choice about where their kids went to school. Or, to put it differently, the only way in which historically Americans could exercise a choice of schools was buy a house in a different neighborhood. Because what determined where your children went to school was where you lived. You couldn't send your child to a district in which you didn't live. You had to send your child to the neighborhood school. And in that sense then, the schools had a captive market of kids based on who lived in the sending area for a particular school. Why shouldn't we have much more opportunity for parents to choose schools for their kids instead of forcing them to send their kids just to those schools close to where they happen to own a house, particularly under circumstances where some families might be able to move out of a $70,000 house into a $350,000 house, but an awful lot of families don't have that choice. So the cost of good schools historically in the United States was, who could afford an expensive house? It's obviously unfair. Why should we deny poor children whose parents can't afford a fancy house in a fancy district access to good schools merely because of their economic circumstances? So there's powerful motives to figure out ways to increase family choice of schools. But the other powerful idea, in addition to family choice of schools, is the private provision of educational services. That is to say, why not allow private vendors of various kinds to begin to offer more educational services of various kinds? Keep in mind that in the United States, we already have private vendors operating within the education sector. For example, school districts contract with private companies for transportation services. School districts contract with private companies for food services, and so on. But the core services of schooling are provided by public employees within a public system, and there is no private vendors who are operating whole schools? Why shouldn't there be? Why wouldn't we think that under the right set of circumstances, private entrepreneurs would be just as good or perhaps better at creating schools as public employees operating within public bureaucracies? Well, potentially there are two policy mechanisms that we could use to introduce more private vendors into education service delivery. You can use contracting, and you can use vouchers. Contracting operates in such a way that a public service could contract services out to any number of firms operating in a competitive environment where you bid on the contracts, and the lowest price with the highest quality wins the bid and is contracted to provide the services. So you could imagine that public schools could make much more active use of contracting with private companies for a wide range of services. The alternative mechanism would be give every family a voucher, a public voucher, a dollar amount, that they could redeem at any school they wanted to. Any school they wanted to. That would include parochial schools, religiously affiliated schools, corporate-run schools, neighborhood public schools. Give families market power through a voucher. And through that mechanism, you would also stimulate the entry into the education market of lots and lots of new providers. These are extraordinary ideas. In some ways, it's hard to know whether it's more extraordinary that these ideas have taken until almost the year 2000 to begin to get play in the United States, or that they're getting play in the United States in the year 2000. Which is the more extraordinary? That's a good question. But what I want to talk to you about today is the beginning, the unfolding of how these ideas are beginning to penetrate education in the United States, most particularly education here in Michigan. Of course, these two big ideas could be combined into a single strategy. That is to say, you could have a mixed regime in which you dramatically diversified service provision within a set of accountability-oriented regulation. And in that sense, then you'd try to get the best of both strongly centralized regulations governing schools with diversification of providers. I'll have more to say about that in a moment, but the way in which you could join these two movements, much more centralized power over the education system with more privatized family choice, would be a regulatory regime of some kind. Well, that's part one. Here's part two, the Michigan case. Turns out that a really interesting place to study these ideas is Michigan. And with a couple of colleagues, David Plank and David Arson, my co-conspirators, we've been studying these recent developments over the last several years through a series of externally funded research projects. And I'm basing today's talk, at least in part, on this research in progress. About a month ago, we issued a report that was the first fruits of our labor. This is the report. I've got a sign-up sheet here for those of you who would like to read all 100 pages of it. Alternatively, I have a sign-up sheet for those of you that would like to read just the 4-page executive summary, if you don't have time for the whole schmear. This report is full of fancy stuff. We got pictures, we got words, we got maps, we got tables, we got numbers. My talk today is going to be data light. You want the details, read the report. I'm going to concentrate today just on the ideas. Here's the background. In 1994, the state of Michigan passed something called Proposal A. This thing was a time bomb. I'll bet half the legislators didn't even recognize what they'd just done, and it has been exploding ever since. It really is an extraordinary piece of legislation. It overturned the way in which the state finances the school system. That may seem like a minor thing, but let me explain to you why it's a major thing. Under the old and traditional system of school finance, some combination of state funds would be combined with local monies raised through such things as millage votes. So that under the old school finance system, local communities could have a lot of influence over how much money was spent on their schools by choosing to levy higher taxes on property. So property taxes essentially funded Michigan schools. And that meant that communities that had a high degree of property wealth could choose to spend more money on education than communities that had a low level of property wealth. This resulted in huge inequities in per pupil expenditures across the state. I mean, on the order of some districts spending $10,000, $12,000 a year per kid, when other districts were spending half that. Rich districts, poor districts, huge inequities. Another feature of the system was that these districts would have money available to them simply based on these tax rates. Didn't matter how many kids were going to schools in the districts. That is to say, let's imagine a district that had a very high levy and was spending a lot of money on kids, and a third of the families in the district chose to withdraw their kids and send them to private schools and pay the tuition. No financial penalty to the district. They got all the money anyway. What did Proposal A do? Proposal A shifted the finance system from property tax to sales tax, pegged a single dollar amount per kid, now around $6,000 a student, and made local school budgets dependent on enrollments. That is to say, now in a school district, the amount of money that the district has to spend on education is equal to the number of kids actually going to school times $6,000 per kid. Let me put this another way. Under the old system, the district owned the money. Under the new system, the kid owns the money. The kid leaves, the money leaves with the kid. All of a sudden, enrollments make a big difference to the 550 school districts in Michigan. The other thing that happened was local districts no longer have the right to raise additional monies through millages, except for capital expenses, not for operating expenses. So for example, if the East Lansing School District right now wants to build a new high school, they can put out a levy to do that as a capital expenditure. What they cannot do is increase their operating expenses by altering any of the tax rates. Who controls how much money goes into education now? State legislature. They're the ones that set the rate at $6,000 per kid or $7,000 per kid or whatever. So the funding has suddenly been centralized to the state level, and local communities no longer have the right to raise funds. Partly that was due to try to equalize spending. And that was part of the rationale behind the move. Now, what happened next? Here's where we rejoin the story about choice and privatization. The next thing the legislature did was they passed a law that allowed for the creation of charter schools and they passed another law that gave families the right to attend schools in districts outside the one they lived in, so-called inter-district choice. The original rule was that you could attend a district within the intermediate district boundaries, but not outside. The new law has expanded that to any contiguous school district from where you live, even if it crosses county boundaries. Now think about what just happened. There's now a school system in which the amount of money that this system has to spend is dependent on enrollments. And all of a sudden, school systems don't have a captive clientele anymore. Why? Because now families can choose to send their kids to charter schools, which means that every kid that goes to a charter school in Lansing is $6,000 taken out of the Lansing Public Schools. Every kid. And every kid who lives in Lansing but whose parents apply to send them to East Lansing or Okemos or Waverly is $6,000 withdrawn from the Lansing Public Schools and added to the budget of Okemos or East Lansing or Waverly. You suddenly have the possibility of districts operating in a competitive relationship to each other in the competition for students and dollars. And you've also set up competitive possibilities between the new charter schools and the public districts in which those charter schools are located. So what's going on here? Family choice has suddenly powerfully been introduced into the state. And we have what is, in effect, the first voucher-ready state in the nation. Not the first state voucher program, that honor goes to Florida. But we're the first voucher-ready state, because as soon as this state enacts a voucher law, the finance system is already set up so that the dollar follows the kid. So right now, we already have a voucher system in principle in place in the state. And the only restriction on the voucher system at the moment is you couldn't choose to go to a private religiously affiliated school with your $6,000. That's the only restriction. That restriction could be removed. And as most of you know, there is a group working to place on the next ballot an initiative that would remove the state constitutional prohibition against public dollars to private religiously affiliated schools, coupled with an initiative to create in certain districts a voucher program that would allow these public voucher dollars to go to these private religious schools. Interestingly, the governor has come out against it. That's a curious fact. So, just to continue this part of it, what's happened in Michigan? Does everybody know what a charter school is? Should I say anything more about that? Okay. In the early 90s, there was an innovation that was developed in the country was the so-called charter school. The idea of a charter school is that you would create a mechanism by which some entity would charter a school. The school would not be part of a school district. It would be a freestanding autonomous school, a new school. It was a vehicle by which, in a state, you could create a whole new set of public schools as a stimulus to inventing lots and lots of new schools. And these schools would be called charter schools, and various agencies of the state could issue the charters to the school, and they could start operating with public money. Well, about 33 of the 50 states now operate charter schools. Three states have the majority of these schools: California, Arizona, and Michigan. So Michigan is one of the leaders among the states in the number of these new kinds of schools. There's enormous variation across states in the way the rules get written for these schools. For example, in Michigan, you can convert a private school to a charter status. Private conversion is prohibited in California. In California, you can put a homeschooling network together and call it a charter school. That was tried in Michigan with the Noah Webster Academy, and the Supreme Court struck it down as unconstitutional. So homeschooling is prohibited. So there's a lot of variation across the states in what charter schools are and how they operate. Another variable is who charters schools. Who charters schools in Michigan? Who are the chartering agents? Universities. The majority are chartered by universities, and the largest single chartering agent is Central Michigan. Not surprising insofar as the governor appointed all the trustees to Central Michigan and is in Mount Pleasant, where he comes from. This is not accidental. Does Michigan State charter any schools? No. Why? Trustees are elected. Trustees have deep ties to the labor movement. These trustees are not interested in chartering schools. Who charters the majority of schools in California? School districts, not universities. Makes a huge difference. Well, charter schools. So what do we have now? Here are the figures. 95, 96, we had about 43 schools. They were serving about 5,500 kids. That was about 0.3% of the student population, and it was encumbering about $31 million of public money. Right this minute, we now have 173 charter schools serving 50,000 kids. It's over 3% of the total student population, and probably around $250 million of public money. So how do you look at that? You can look at it in two ways. You can say, oh, it's only 3% of the kids, 173 schools. Or you can say, that movement grew tenfold in 3 or 4 years. Which do you choose to look at as significant? The overall size or the explosive growth? Obviously, the growth suggests there was huge pent-up demand in at least some communities in Michigan for schooling alternatives, because this growth has been so explosive. But on the other hand, the charter movement is still in its infancy. It's only 4 or 5 years old. How about inter-district choice? About 45% of Michigan school districts have opted into it. There are now about 15,000 students who've taken advantage of it, so that between them, you've got about 65,000 students total of Michigan's 1.6 million students who are participating in some kind of school of choice as we speak. How about what we called in our report the geography of choice? Where is participation emerging? Let me just put it to you, if you had to guess. I'll give you the answer. But if you had to guess in Michigan, 173 charter schools now around the state, what would be your guess as to where these schools are springing up, and why would you guess there? Huh? Yeah. For example? No, communities. Wrong. You're wrong. I'll explain it. What would you guess, Barry? Urban areas where there's the most dissatisfaction. You said Lansing. Lansing is one. Other guesses? How about inter-district choice? Where would you guess people are participating in that around the state? Same place as the charter schools are located? Yeah. That's true. Well, you've got it just about right. And Barry was on the money. Here's what our research shows. 43% of all charter schools are located in the Detroit metro area. About 37 charter schools are in Detroit. As it now stands, there is not a family in Detroit that is not within a mile or two of a charter school. Charter schools are disproportionately located in urban areas with low test scores and high concentrations of poor and minority families. Charter school enrollments are predominantly minority, but this is changing somewhat. And the two largest concentrations in the state of charter schools are Detroit and Grand Rapids. But the social significance of those concentrations is different in those two cities. Interdistrict transfers are both urban and rural. So you can imagine in a rural area why you'd take advantage of this. Let's imagine that you're right on the boundary of a district, only the school you've got to go to is 20 miles away, but across the line is a school 5 miles away. And it's only because of the district boundary that you can't go to the school 5 miles away. So just on transportation and convenience alone, lots of families in rural areas take advantage of interdistrict transfers. But you also have a lot of rural families that are doing it too. Lansing's been a big loser. Big time loser. One of the most heavily affected districts in the state of Michigan. There are now 7 or 8 charter schools operating in Lansing. They've been hemorrhaging students to East Lansing, to Okemos. They've lost thousands of kids and tens of millions of dollars under these policies. It's been a massive effect on a place like Lansing. The movement under interdistrict choice is two districts with higher incomes, higher MEEP scores, and lower concentrations of minority students. That's what our research shows. We characterize this as a process of upward filtering. Now, there's one other significant feature of these developments that I want to point out to you. One of the original arguments for charter schools was that there was a lot of good ideas floating around in our society about schools, and what we had to do was to unleash the creativity of all kinds of people who wanted to start new schools, and that under the current rule-bound, bureaucratic, public system of schooling, entrepreneurs, innovators were frustrated. They really didn't have any way in which they could take good ideas for new schools and get them started. So part of the argument in favor of charter schools all over the country was that by creating the opportunity to create new schools with public dollars, you could unleash innovation. Well, what's happened in Michigan? What's happened is this. Currently, 70% of all of the charter schools have contracts with education management organizations. What's an education management organization? I'm going to get to that in a minute, but that's not it. It's this. Mom and pop can't run a school. They don't have the capital. The $6,000 per kid doesn't cover their costs. They can't do all of the things administratively and fiscally that's needed to run a school. A lot of mom and pop schools started up under the charter laws. What happened to them? They started to fold. Who stepped in to begin to provide the infrastructure for schools that school districts traditionally have? Private for-profit companies. Who? The Leona Group here in Lansing. The Edison Project. National Heritage Academies. Mosaica. And about a half dozen others. Remember what I said earlier. why not turn schooling over to private companies? The choice movement is powerfully intersecting with the privatization movement in Michigan. And Michigan is on the leading edge because of the particular way that the charter school legislation was written. That is to say, the reason that all these companies are finding Michigan so hospitable a place to begin to operate is the state didn't provide any capital startup funds for the charter schools. The state explicitly allows education management organizations to operate. They are prohibited in California. The $6,000 per kid across all schools creates an economic circumstance that private firms can capitalize on. Charter schools don't have to pay into the state retirement system, so they can set up 401k plans, which is economically advantageous relative to what regular public schools can do. So a whole series of circumstances make it extremely advantageous for private, for-profit firms to begin running charter schools. These things vary enormously. Some of them provide limited services. Some of them, like Edison, provide a whole school model. You buy the whole thing. Michigan has the most. Now, here's the question. Here's the question. If you are going to organize and run a school in order to make a profit, how would you do that? And would the strategy you develop to run a school for profit produce educational quality? Do we care? Do we care if a private for-profit company is running a school and by some reckoning it's not providing high-quality services for all children? One answer is, yeah, we care a lot. It's public dollars. But there's another answer. The other answer is the market test. The only test a school has to pass is, does it attract families? That's the only test. That's the only test it has to pass. So the advocates for choice and privatization want to say, we're not going to raise questions about somebody's idea about quality as long as some bunch of families choose to send their kids to the school and it can operate, it should. That's the test. That's the test. Alternatively, as you could imagine, others might be saying, wait a minute, we're going to have a whole system of schools run by private for-profit vendors, and the only test is whether they can attract parents or not? What's wrong with this picture? Do you begin to see why these developments are not minor? These are deeply significant, transformational events in the history of American public education. And we're on the cutting edge of it here in Michigan, although not only in Michigan. I'll end with a few thoughts on this and then open it up for questions. At this juncture in the talk, we could pursue three questions. What have been the consequences of these developments, public and private, individual and collective, for what's going on here? It's what our research is trying to figure out. And that's an interesting story. It's also a puzzle as to what sorts of research methods you use to try to figure out what consequences this is having. That's not an easy problem. We're struggling as we speak trying to work that out. Second question is, what accounts for the emergence of these developments at this historical juncture? And a third question is, what does the future hold? I won't talk to you today about the consequences question. Our report gets into that. We can talk about that later. I want to say a few things, though, about those final two questions. Why is this happening? And what's the future? So in a nutshell, here is a political, an economic, a social, and an educational explanation for why these developments have unfolded in the state. First, a political explanation. We live in a postmodern time. Rising distrust with our institutions, a period in which the labor movement in this country has declined dramatically, an historical circumstance in Michigan in which the decline of the automobile industry sent a shockwave through the entire state and created a certain kind of receptivity to change. And that set of circumstances created the opportunity for a governor, a conservative Republican governor, who had spent his entire career in the state legislature getting beaten up year after year after year by the state's single most powerful lobby, the Michigan Education Association, the teachers' union. And when he got to be governor, it was payback time. It was payback time. Governor Engler, in the course of his tenure, has worked a It is an amazing political success story of a terrifically skillful politician who went after his worst enemy and destroyed them. The political motivation for such things as Proposal A, charter schools, inter-district choice, is clearly to weaken the power of the teachers' union. Charter school teachers are non-unionized. Charter school teachers increasingly work on contracts provided by education management organizations. They work on at-will contracts. They have no tenure. There is no collective bargaining. Do you see where this is going politically? Engler did two things. He introduced choice into the education system as a means to weaken the teachers' union, and he eviscerated the Michigan Department of Education. The Michigan Department of Education today is a hollow shell. It doesn't exist. You can shoot a cannon through those hallways downtown and you won't hit anybody. If you'd look at any measure of that department, number of employees, budget, responsibilities, it's been destroyed. What happened? The old political iron triangle between lobbying groups, regulatory agency, and legislative committees, which in Michigan meant the State Department of Education, the teachers' union as the most powerful lobbying group in the state, and legislative committees that oversaw that, has been broken. And now, power over school finance is in the hands of legislators. You're not locally bargaining for anything anymore. There is no more local bargaining in Michigan. Why? Proposal A. Phenomenal success story. Powerful political motives. You could analyze Margaret Thatcher's destruction of the education lobby in England 10 years earlier as a textbook case along the same lines. So conservative politicians around the world are tumbling to many of these same strategies to go after their political enemies. Second, economic. Two powerful motives here. One motive is to shift costs from public to the private sector and to reduce pressures on public expenditures. If in a state you could get more people for a $3,000 or a $2,000 voucher to send their kids to parochial schools, where they would be making up the difference between the tuition at the parochial school and the public voucher, you just offloaded a lot of money from the public treasury into private households. Almost all governments are constantly struggling with fiscal pressures to exert upward fiscal pressures on state budgets. What's the single largest budget item in any state's budget? Education. within the education budget, what is the single largest line item? Teacher salaries. Teacher salaries. What do we know about teacher salaries for charter school teachers versus regular public school teachers? Dramatically lower. One of the ways in which you can extract profit from charter schools is hire younger teachers, pay them less, don't allow for collectively bargained contracts and job protections, pay less into benefits and retirement packages. Are you with me? That is to say, there are lots of ways in which you can reduce pressures on public expenditures for education. That's an economic motive. What's the second? Open up the $350 billion education enterprise to new capital investment in the midst of the most unprecedented economic boom the nation's ever known. The Edison Project last week made their first IPO. Didn't do so well, but they've gone public in trading stock in their company. There are corporations all over the country now eager to get into the education market. And by opening up privatized opportunities through either contracting or vouchers, you create enormous new investment opportunities for corporations to start to provide education services. Powerful economic motives to introduce choice and privatization. Yeah. Well, you could think of a number of reasons. One would be you could say that you love a particular school and you really believe in it and you want to work there. For example, how do private school teacher salaries compare with public? Lower. Why would anyone teach at a parochial school? They're Catholic. They believe in the mission. They care. That's one kind of an answer. Another kind of an answer is they can't get jobs anywhere else. And there are others. It's a market. Yeah. Right. So, you're a poor black family living in an inner city, and you are completely persuaded by generations of experience that the public school that you have to send your child to is racist, indifferent, alienating, and is likely to do a miserable job. And there's a charter school that's just opened 15 minutes from your house, and it happens to be affiliated with the church that you go to. Are you going to be the one to tell that family that that charter school isn't very good and they ought not to send them there and that they shouldn't have that choice? Who are you to say? Yes. Yes. You're absolutely right. And now what you're doing, and I'm playing devil's advocate a bit for charter schools here, but what you're pointing out, and this is one of the points that we make in our report, when you try to assess the consequences of this movement, you have to look not only at what happens to the families and the kids who go to schools of choice, but also what happens to the schools that people leave, because there are kids and teachers and so on left in those schools. You have to look at all those things. Yeah. Right, right.
Wouldn't it just end up being the same situation that we have now? Because only those who are on the upper end of the income ladder would be able to make up the difference between the tuition and the voucher that you get. So thus you still have the poor people going to the same crumbling public schools that they already have.
Yeah, so that begins then to get into technical considerations of how the size of a voucher would influence the behavior of families at different economic points on the spectrum. Obviously, the larger the voucher relative to the actual cost, the more families could take advantage of it. The problem with all of that calculation, though, is you don't know how that might affect the tuition behavior of the schools. So there are a whole set of tricky calculations about what dynamics would ensue around introducing vouchers pegged at $1,500, $3,000, $4,500. And we don't know the answers to those, although economists have run simulations trying to work out the points at which you'd affect movement into private schools.
Did
you want to? Right.
Also, private schools aren't required to really let in all the students that apply. They can be very
selective.
Selective and biased.
Yes.
How they let in students, wouldn't that have an effect on the state?
Yeah. So then the question is, what amount of regulation would a private school have to exchange for public subsidization? None? Not very likely. Some? How much? What kinds? So when I've talked to private conversion school operators who have gone charter, they've said to me, we had to do it because the tuition was so hard for our poor families to pay that I had to do it. That would be the case of a charter school in the Detroit area that was affiliated with a Black Baptist church that was serving working class Black families who were struggling to make the tuition. They made the decision to convert from a private Baptist school to a charter school, and they had to strip away a lot of the religious aspects of their curriculum and their community in order to do it. I also talked to a Montessori school operator in another community who refused to go charter because she felt that the unique character of the school would be lost if they had to submit to the regulations to operate as a charter school, and they wanted to maintain their independence. So private schools around the state right now with respect to the charter law are making a range of decisions. But what's clear is that there is going to come increased regulation along with access to public money. How do you make that trade-off? A lot of schools are facing that.
It strikes me that you don't end up in the situation because the wealthy districts have these plans that come to either for themselves or for students. They have other means of getting families raising money, regional foundations, or family participation, or whatever. So what you've done is you've given people who maybe have
It has historically been very difficult to level down to achieve equality. Politically, that's almost impossible. You can't tell affluent communities what they can't do to support their kids. So the only choice politically you've got to pursue greater equity is to try to figure out how to level up the have-nots. What you said is exactly right. Have charter schools located in affluent suburban districts like Bloomfield Hills or the others? Are there a lot of charter schools operating in those kinds of districts? Nah. Have those kinds of districts opted into inter-district transfers? Nah. Look, if you can afford a $400,000 house in a fancy suburb, you got what you want. There's no market for charter schools. There's no reason to accept kids coming from other districts in unless there's some unusual circumstance. So at the upper end of the distribution, choice hasn't touched schools at all in the state. This is almost all about poor schools, poor districts, poor communities, and trying to figure out how to expand choices for them. The $64 million question, though, is, if in expanding choice, are you also improving quality? That's a really tough question to answer in any definitive way. And that's why the advocates for choice want to take the question off the table. For them, it is good enough that a family makes a choice. It's the case I just said. It's the poor family who says, don't talk to me about what's wrong with that charter school because I know how miserably my child is being treated in the public school they have to go to. That is the most important existential reality in our life. Any choice is better than this school I have to go to. And the explosive growth of these choice policies testifies to the fact in Michigan that there is a lot of pent-up frustration with the regular public schools. That is undeniable. That doesn't get at whether the charter schools are going to do any better a job or the schools that they transfer into are going to do any better. It only says there are a lot of poor minority families in Michigan who are desperate for a choice and who didn't have access to private schools or moving into the suburbs to get access to better schools. That's what it says. Whether these new alternatives constitute better education, your guess is as good as mine, and the likelihood is some of these charter schools are very good. Some of them are wretched. That is, there's a quality distribution among charter schools just like there is among any other set of schools. Some are good, some are bad, and parents are not particularly keen choosers. That is to say, it's very hard, even for very knowledgeable, concerned parents to figure out just what a good school is. It's not an easy thing to figure that out for anybody. Yeah. Yes.
That's correct. They learn about the history of blacks. They don't get public school.
You bet. Same is true of Native Americans and other groups. And that's
itself is an improvement.
Yes, it is certainly an improvement from the perspective of those people taking advantage of that. And that leads me to remember I had four interpretive frames, the political, the economic, the social. This is a good segue into that. The social interpretation of why choice, why this development is, it is very much about race, religion, and social class in the United States. That what is going on in our country today is the erosion of the common school ideal and its replacement with a new ideal. Let's call it the uncommon school. That gives play to the construction of particularistic communities bound by culture, race, religious preference, and similarity. That what Americans are saying is we want to abandon the original ideal of the American Common School in favor of publicly funded schools that allow for the construction of very particularistic communities. Ethnic identity communities, basic skills curriculum, religiously tinged Christian fundamentalist communities that are right on the verge of breaching the church-state separation line, and so on. So that within the charter movement, we have African-centered education, Native American education, Armenian education, and others. We have schools that in every respect are Christian fundamentalist in their orientation and that are drawing students out of private Christian fundamentalist schools because they look so much like them. We have schools that cater to other niche markets around vocational education, around particular kinds of instructional ideologies. Powerful, powerful social motivations to support these kinds of schools that have not been possible within the one-size-fits-all, vanilla-flavored American public school as it's developed historically. The other thing that you have, and not least in Michigan, is part of the ongoing abandonment of desegregation as a social policy goal in the country, because charter schools create opportunities to resegregate schools. So that districts like Lansing and others that have been operating under court-ordered desegregation, in which children of both races have been bused to create more racial balance within the schools, well, when onto that kind of a system, you now create a whole set of charter schools and give parents a chance to vote with their feet, guess what? They're separating along lines of race and class into these schools. And so there are powerful social motivations that tap into deep changes going on within our society around these matters. What do these things say to me about this movement? I got to tell you, it's irresistible. Think about a political coalition that brings together corporate and business interests with minority communities, with the Republican Party, with New Democrats, as a political base to drive a movement forward. That's powerful. That's a politically powerful coalition. That's the coalition in Michigan and elsewhere that's fueling this movement. Big corporations see profits. Lots and lots of local communities see the opportunity to create schools that they can own, that are not part of some remote bureaucracy. The whole ideology of markets fits perfectly with the Republican agenda. But we got Bill Clinton coming out in favor of charter schools. So you can't just trace this to the Republican Party and its political ideology. It's broader than that. It's more inclusive. We're going in this direction. And just to conclude with the question of the future, you can imagine two scenarios, more than two at least, but two. One is transformation, the other is marginal adjustment. Where is this movement going? Well, the marginal adjustment scenario is this. This whole movement is going to wind up operating just in trouble areas within our society, the cities, and other places at the low end. It's going to maybe increase to as much as 10% of the population taking part of these choices, but not much beyond that. And it's going to focus on niche markets and specialized services. Because there isn't overwhelming discontent in our society with schools. There's discontent in pockets. Urban education, among the poor, among minorities who feel disenfranchised and alienated from white middle class schools. So The discontent is concentrated. It's not diffuse. It's not pervasive. And consequently, this movement is going to hit a ceiling of spread. Well, the other scenario is that we're going to move to a much deeper penetration into our whole system of schools to ultimately transform it. And what we're going to get is, in the future, the American school system is going to be much more highly differentiated. You're going to have corporate-run schools. You're going to have public neighborhood schools. You're going to have private schools. You're going to have neighborhood ethnic identity schools that are highly particularistic in character. You're going to have what is going to replace a monolithic public school monopoly system, a much more differentiated set of schools that are going to give play to a much broader set of motives, and so that the entire system is going to come to look very different than it does today. Ironically, and I'll end on this note, if you go back to the so-called systemic reformers that see the current system as being highly fragmented and incoherent and in need of standards, the irony is that this movement is likely to increase fragmentation and incoherence within the overall system of schools in the country, moving us even further away from, say, the ideal of Japan or Germany or Singapore. That is, a national standardized system of schools that provides common resources, commonly qualified teachers, common instructional materials, national curriculum, national testing system. And we're moving toward even more fragmentation of offerings, a further fracturing of the school system over against the kinds of systems that have taken shape in other countries. Well, that's all I got to say. Should we talk some more? How are we doing on time? 4:17. So if you want, ask some more questions. Yeah. That's correct.
Lawsuits going on because taxpayers' money will be going to support the religious indoctrination of children.
Yes.
And that this is unconstitutional. And that the religious right is very much in favor of vouchers because...
So is the Catholic Church. They'd love to get that money.
Because this furthers government support of and making Christianity a state religion of this country, which is part of what they really want to do.
Yes.
So there is a opposition on this.
Well, sure. I mean, let's say that you have a country in which you want to make it absolutely certain that the government cannot impose religion on its people. You have two choices. One choice is that you absolutely separate schools from religion. That's one choice. But there's another choice. You let every religion have access to funds so that all kinds of religious schools could have some public funding. Among the nations in the world, the only nation that took the first choice was ours. Every other nation that also features a diversity of religious preferences tends to have models in which a wide range of religiously affiliated schools has access to some public funding. So, is it time for the United States to rethink the church-state separation doctrine? Well, there are many people now who believe it is time. And one prediction is that within our lifetime, possibly within the next decade, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, will hear a case on this and may very well overturn the doctrine in favor of providing public funds for religiously affiliated schools. That needn't be a threat. That is to say, if Christian fundamentalists want to have access to funds for their schools, well, if every other religious group also has access to those funds where they can send their children, then you're still preserving religious freedom. That is to say, Christian fundamentalists can't make anybody attend their schools. They may simply be saying, we want religious instruction in our schools, and if you want to have your own school for your religion and you have some religious instruction to complement the official secular curriculum, that's fine. Atheists can form schools too. Absolutely. Why not? I think the question there, Sandy, is what is the regulatory structure under which all schools would operate? That is the $64 million question, because you would have to have some common body of regulations that all schools, regardless of their affiliation, would have to operate under. That's where the battle would be. Exactly. That's where the battle would be. And the argument probably would be that you'd want to have minimal regulations. What that would mean then would be that one school might teach creationist evolution, and another school might teach Darwinian evolution. Under one version, the state would be indifferent to that. Under another version, there would have to be a state-mandated curriculum that all schools would have to teach. And there would be a state test that all kids would have to take. And that's where the battles would be fought out. Yeah.
You started out by saying that a lot of what's happening seems from generalized dissatisfaction.
Right.
That's an argument that I don't hear being made by people who I would think of as in the education establishment. Or,
right.
Why not?
It is being made. And remember, it's being made by a set of scholars who are writing in the scholarly journals. And essentially what they're doing is they're reviewing the evidence about achievement and attainment in the U.S. system, and they're saying, this is a good system. There's no other system of schooling in the world that tries to educate as diverse a group of children for as many years as the United States. Most other systems are highly selective. The further up you go in the system, the more you start to differentiate opportunity and slot kids. We don't do that. Ours is a system of second chances. It's imperfect, but it's basically a sound system. And these scholars also want to say, if you want to know the main thing that's wrong with education, it's not the education, it's poverty. You want to know what's wrong with education? It's that education isn't working in our country in communities where families and kids and the whole community are desperately poor. And you can't break out of that. and we want to blame schools for a problem that is not of the school's making. So you want to improve the education system. This isn't about more choice. This is about treating underlying economic conditions and gross inequalities in our society. Well, those are arguments that are being made. They're not arguments that are being heard within our political environment. They are not. They are not. Partly because the conclusion of that argument is, therefore, we have to pump more public monies into X, Y, or Z, which typically means more government programs, which are in disfavor because big government is out of favor, and the policy of choice today is more markets, market-oriented solutions. That takes us back to John Engler and charter schools and choice and vouchers and all the rest. Well, we don't know that yet. What if it's the case that those kids are going to get learn better? I mean, right now, what you're missing, Sandy, I think, is...
I'm not saying that it's better now. I'm saying that what you're going to have is people who have an identity who are now going to be able to say, this identity, in other words, you're providing sort of nationalism of this, you're focusing it on their group rather than
Yeah.
What if
it's the case that identity politics in this country is shifting, and that the historical arguments in favor of trying to use that the public schools are the single most important institution in our society for making Americans, for teaching lessons of tolerance and civility and participation in the democratic way of life, and there's only one institution in our society that can do that. Only one that touches every single citizen. It's the schools. Now, what if we say, well, we really think it's much more important that people hone their particular identities as those identities are shaped by race, culture, language, religious preference, and other things, and that is a more important function for the schools to serve than this civic function. Now you're in the middle of the argument. Now you are in the middle of the argument, but I have to tell you who's on the losing end right now. It is the defenders of the public system in its civic functions. They're losing the argument, the public debate on that today in this country. And that's another reason that I think these new developments are deeply significant, because they're pointing to deep shifts in the way in which Americans are thinking about themselves and the future of their country. It's fateful stuff. Yeah.
Much better and succeed better if they have a good, solid grounding first in who they are and their culture.
There you are.
Then go on, they do much better.
Yes, those are powerful, powerful beliefs. And I think that if I had to point to one thing that powerfully fuels this movement toward charter schools, choice, and vouchers, other than the politics and the fact that corporations want to make money and all that, it's that in our urban schools, in schools in poor communities across the country, we've given up hope that some kind of reform of the system as it's currently operating is going to work. We just don't believe it anymore. We have tried to reform urban schools and rurally isolated schools for 100 years now, and by and large, nothing has worked. Hasn't worked. So the families, the kids, the people living in those communities are saying now, we have to have choices. We no longer believe that turning the solution to the problem of our schools over to some public bureaucracy, school boards, superintendent, principals, teachers' unions, that whole machinery that runs the system, we just don't believe in them anymore. They're not going to change anything. They're not going to serve us well. And therefore, it's worth trying a system in which more control is given directly to families and parents because they have some choices to exercise. And they believe things like, if Native American children are schooled by Native Americans in who they are, that is going to provide a context in which ultimately they're going to learn more. It gives play to those kinds of beliefs. It's these are powerful motives behind this. But notice those motives get connected to motives like John Engler's desire to beat up the MEA and corporate interests that want to begin to make profits. That's why I'm saying you've got, from a whole series of different vantage points, the possibilities of coalitions to form to drive these policies. Strange bedfellows, the old expression, politics makes strange bedfellows. We've got very strange bedfellows behind this movement for choice, privatization, markets, and so on. Very strange bedfellows. They're winning the argument for all the reasons I've laid out. They're winning the argument. Speaking personally, I think it's very distressing because I see in this movement, in these developments, terrific potential for harm, for damage, for deep, deep problems in this country. But my guess is that those problems are going to have to emerge more powerfully than they yet have before you begin to get some counter movement. Because this movement isn't going to be slowed down by people saying, what if? It's not going to happen. It's too powerful. Yeah. Right. Sure. Well, let's imagine that you went to the mother and the father of a third grade child who was placed in a charter school as a minority, and you put that question to them. And they said, well, maybe, but I still think it's more important that my child be in this single race school for purposes of identity, esteem, and development. Should the state say they don't get that opportunity if that's the choice they want to make? So would you want to say that you want to substitute your opinion for the child's parents' opinion? Well, that's what this debate's about. It's about whether the parents have the right to make that kind of decision on behalf of their child, as opposed to being in a situation where the system says to the parent, we don't care what you believe, your kid's going to the neighborhood school in which there's a lot of diversity, but maybe your kid gets lost, doesn't get treated well, we feel alienated from the school, we can't go into the school to talk to the teacher because we're put off. All the things that poor and minority parents have been saying about the public schools generation after generation. There is profound alienation because public schools are, par excellence, white middle-class institutions. And they're training children to participate in white middle-class society. Now, maybe that's good, but maybe that's a problem. And that's an old argument in the United States, and we will never fully resolve it. And it's and that argument is playing out once again within the charter school movement. But what's happening this time is the side of the argument that says it's more important for us to cultivate our separate identity than to cultivate our common identity is winning. Is winning at the end of the 20th century. And potentially that is pointing to a different kind of a social future for our society than what we've had. And it's possible that that policies like desegregation have run and have run to the point of exhaustion. And the future is very much up in the air. Yours is a good question. It's a good question. But people are willing to say at this point, I'll risk that because dumping my kid into a school that's diverse but crummy and unresponsive hasn't worked. Because that was the education I was raised with. And I didn't like it. And I don't feel that the school's responsive to me. What do you say about that? Because that's what a lot of parents are saying. And that's a tough call. Well, folks, thanks for coming. Wasn't exactly upbeat, maybe enlightening.